This session from the Adelaide Festival of Ideas 2011 was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Bar Smith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library and Flinders University Library.
So welcome to today's forum on Creative Nation Revisited. And I'd like to start by acknowledging that we are today gathered on the traditional country of the Kaurna people of the Adelaide Plains. Welcome too, especially to our speakers, Julianne Schultz and Will Emmett. Some housekeeping before we get going. I am going to ask you if you would put your phones on silent. If you would like to tweet during the event, you're most welcome to, and tweet at Adelaide Ideas, and we have the hashtag AFO. Also, we do have a fairly tight time schedule, as you know. I imagine most of you and most of us are running from one session to another, so I will endeavour to try and keep everyone to that time schedule, and apologies in advance if I cut you short and if I cut the speakers short, so I'm exonerating myself here. I was actually really, really fortunate to be at the launch of Creative Nation many years ago. And I remember coming out of that launch and walking down that fabulous hill there, Capitol Hill, and together with a lot of other arts peers, thinking and feeling truly, truly euphoric. Finally, we thought Australia had come of age, Australia was going to be defined by its creativity, culture, and the arts were no longer at the margins of society. Well, a lot has happened since then. The political and economic landscapes have totally changed. And also, the cultural sector has been impacted by this and also by the huge transformation that has been brought about by the tools of digitisation. And they have transformed how we can create, distribute and indeed consume our culture. So it's really, really timely that on the eve of the development of a new cultural policy and a new cultural discussion paper, that we have two, I think, exciting speakers today to offer their perspectives on what did we achieve, what does Creative Nation mean today. And the first of our speakers is Julianne Schultz. She is the founding editor of the Griffith Review, the prestigious quarterly of ideas published by Griffith University, where she is also a professor. Julianne is also a director on the boards of the ABC and the Grattan Institute, and she co-chairs the Queensland Design Council. She also co-chaired the Creative Australia stream at the 2020 Summit, and she was appointed a member of the Ministerial Arts for Creative Australia Advisory Group. She was also the coordinating author of New Models, New Money report published in 2010. So she's been there really at where the seeds were planted for some of the new ideas for the new policy discussion and has been able to see how they have evolved right into the policy paper. And our second speaker will be Will Emmett, and he's the CEO of the Left-Right Think Tank, Australia's first independent, non-partisan think tank of young minds with a mission to involve young people in public policy. Will's personal commitment to sustainability and empowerment through education and new thinking have seen his involvement in the delivery of projects for Shell Australia, the Australian and US governments, and the ABC. He sits on the Australia Youth Affairs Coalition Policy Advisory Council, and just because he has spare time, he is also involved personally in the strategy and marketing development for an internet startup focused on sustainable and collaborative consumption. So you can see we're going to get some really interesting perspectives here. Julianne, I thought we might start with you, if you'd like to take the lectern.
Thanks very much, Therese. It's a great privilege to be here and to be having this conversation. And it is encouraging to hear your enthusiasm about that early adoption of Creative Nation in the early 1990s. I do think that when we're discussing creativity and imagination, that the very idea of what it means to be Australian, it's particularly important to acknowledge the traditional owners, as you have done. their long history of engagement with this land is one of the things that gives this country its uniqueness, something that can't be replicated anywhere else. In the context of the topic today, I think this is particularly important, because although the authors of Creative Nation recognise the uniqueness of Indigenous art and culture and its potential, both in terms of representing Australia and giving the creators and custodians of that art and culture a way of reaching between their traditions and the commercial modern world, they did not, I think, fully comprehend the significance and the integral nature of Indigenous culture in terms of defining that first national cultural policy that was released in 1993. I don't say this as a criticism, but it was one of the examples of how the understanding of culture, its development and its capacity, changes as the world around us changes, as it responds and adapts to find new niches and new opportunities, as some things become clearer, we change the focus with which we see things. So while acknowledging the traditional owners, the traditional Indigenous owners here, I'd also like to acknowledge the visionary folk who imagined this city and what it might become. One's reminded of it every time one walks down these wide boulevards, and I was doing this this morning, looking at the plaques on the footpath as you walk through, or enjoys the green belt that rings the city. This city is very much a product, and this state is very much a product of a creative, imaginative approach to creating a new settlement in a different place. For me, there is also a personal connection. My mother's family settled here well over a century ago. They were not in the first wave of German settlers, but they weren't that far behind. And going up to the hills yesterday afternoon, I was reminded of the richness of their legacy, but also of the hardships they endured in a culture which was not always so accepting of diversity. And to some extent, it's converse, the consequences for an ethnic group which seeks to remain apart from the mainstream. Both of these groups of settlers, the reforming visionaries and the religious refugees, I think have helped create the ethos of this city and the culture it enjoys today. This is in conjunction and in a way in juxtaposition to the Indigenous Australians who were here first. Again, when thinking of the Creative Nation report that was written nearly 20 years ago, there's a lot of recognition of the importance of diversity in that document. 1993 was in some ways the high watermark in terms of the endorsement of an inclusive multiculturalism here. But as with the recognition of Indigenous heritage, we have moved a long way since then in the way that we frame that recognition, even though, in my view, we've not pursued the inclusive multicultural agenda with the vigour and imagination I would have hoped for over the last 15 years or so. I mention both these dimensions of the shaping of culture because we sometimes tend to think of culture as the product of arts groups or government agencies that fund the arts and fail to build on the connections back to the reason we're engaged with it at all, beyond the urgent need, of course, that many artists have to create works of imagination and beauty just because that's who they are, to questions of identity and belonging. In the current discussion paper that Simon Crean released almost a month ago now on the proposed new national cultural policy, both diversity and the centrality of Indigenous culture take centre stage, the first principle on which the policy is being built. It's a long way from the impetus for Creative Nation. In many ways, that document, with its extremely elegant framing words and its long and rather prescriptive list of agencies and institutions that it was designed to support, was at the end of a long run of sort of cultural nationalism. It was a framing that started well before Federation and ran through last century until it found its clear expression in the last decade of the 20th century in that lovely document, Creative Nation. Cultural nationalism was not something unique to Australia. It was a movement which gained momentum in all the former colonies. The last big wave of decolonisation was realised several decades after the Second World War finally blew apart the old power blocks and the subservience and acquiescence demanded in the settled states. Of course, the cultural nationalism in places like France had a different wellspring and never really died. The opposition to the new cultural power of America and a determination to preserve the elements of what made France and the French unique, language, design, culture, fashion, art, literature, philosophy, film and so on, shaped a different sort of cultural nationalism than that which we saw here. In Australia, I think you can argue that it led to the creation of the Australia Council, the Film Commission, the National Performing Arts Companies, the Australian Studies Movement in schools and universities.
indeed almost my entire university degree at the University of Queensland in the mid-1970s, was shaped by the Australian Studies movement. I did courses in Australian literature, Australian politics, Australian sociology, history and government. It was actually a much richer sort of body of knowledge, I think, to study than you would probably find now in many of the Australian Studies areas, because it's been so diluted. But to my mind, Creative Nation, when it was pulled together by that eminent committee of writers, artists, historians and intellectuals, was the culmination of the push for a cultural expression of what it meant to be Australian, that found it found its enduring voice in places like the poems of Dorothea McKellar or Banjo Paterson, in the stories of Henry Lawson, the paintings of Streeton and Drysdale. This was, of course, just a partial expression, but one which gained several wonderful new layers in the post-war years, with artists like Sidney Nolan and Arthur Boyd and writers like Patrick White and Xavier Herbert, but which was still very much largely defined by reference back to the mother country, to which, of course, many of the most talented and original artists and intellectuals had fled, never to return. A significant section of the introduction to Creative Nation, to the report, explores the problems of the cultural cringe that this created. It also explores the danger of the cultural strut, the opposite of the cringe, in which all things Australian were considered better than anything from abroad. Creative Nation expressed the fond hope that we had moved beyond both. At the time, it may have been true, but I fear that in the following decades we've probably erred a little bit more towards the strut than the cringe. Happy to praise what we're doing, to elevate the local, to valorise the ochre, at least initially with an ironic tone, but increasingly on its own terms. Interestingly, this has shown up in the international polls about national standing that Australians participate in. Former diplomat Alison Bronowski noticed this when she recently drew attention to Australia's ranking on various national league tables. Remember, our economy places us about 13th in the world. We're not insignificant. In fact, we're one of the world's richest countries. And this is about where we rate in many of the indices that have been developed, up on some, down on others, but around that sort of point. The one index in which we rate first is one that's done by an organisation called the Reputation Index, and the Reputation Institute. And the Reputation Institute's index is a measure of self-image, the trust, admiration, respect and pride that people from 33 countries have in themselves. On this single index, Australia came first. We rate ourselves very highly. Canada came second, the USA third, Japan came last, and New Zealand didn't rate a mention. So it's sort of completely at odds with where we rank in everything else, but our self-confidence is good. I mean, the confidence is a good thing. Observers like the BBC's former Australian correspondent Nick Bryant recently described Australia as a place which is seen as a place of innovation, cultural excellence and diversity. And no doubt this is true. You only have to look at the international engagement with Australian artists, designers, the adulation for Australian trained actors, the ranking of Australian authors. But closer to home, it still feels a bit more uncertain, a bit more tentative, that the spirit is willing but the flesh is weak. When Creative Nation was written and released with great fanfare and excitement, at last we could define ourselves on our own terms with our own artists and institutions and cultural industries. At the time, no one really questioned the cultural nationalism frame in the way in which we would today. And I became very aware of that during the 2020 summit, when the younger artists and people who were involved in the Creative Australia stream really just didn't want to engage with the sort of cultural nationalism frame that people of my generation and older just took as a given. But of course, there is something unique to being Australian, which includes but goes beyond the heritage of Indigenous and settler diversity, but can no longer be defined by a simple binary or a one-layered notion of identity. The world and we have become more complex, more layered, more engaged, more interested in creating culture as well as consuming it. The arts, design and culture now intrude in every bit of our lives, from the food we eat, to the clothes we wear, to the entertainment we seek, the places we live and work, to the way we spend our leisure time, to our quest for imaginative, environmental and scientific solutions, to the way our kids are educated, to the things that give us a sense of social cohesion and belonging, and that enables us to welcome newcomers and tell our stories and sell our products abroad. When Creative Nation was written, the concerns were slightly different. Although on rereading the report, it's striking just how similar both the underlying issues and the tentative solutions are. We tend to look back on the past as an easier, sort of happier time, but at the time it didn't feel like that. Nearly 20 years ago, those responsible for Australia's first national cultural policy wanted to ensure that, in their words, and I quote, what used to be called a cultural desert does not become a sea of globalised homogenised mediocrity. averting this dire, bland future was the key challenge that was set, a challenge the committee addressed by giving the government of the day a long and rather prescriptive list of programs and initiatives that might solve the problem with what they described as imagination and wit. The checklist of their recommendations is striking. A statement of cultural rights, a recommendation that addressing the challenge of convergence, of technological convergence, it was that in response to that threat, it was best to incorporate arts and communications. And I note that 20 years later, we're again having an inquiry into the consequences of convergence. Relocating the orchestras, creating 10 CD-ROMs to capture the national heritage, an Academy of Music, an Academy of Indigenous Art, and reshaping the Australia Council and the tax system on film rebates. They were in the checklist of this document. Creative Nation is, of course, one of the few government reports that's had a life well beyond its own, beyond the first day it was tabled in Parliament. The phrase itself became a rallying call, a statement of ambition, and one that, like Lucky Country, endures, a testament to the enduring good quality, the quality of good writing and the ability of well-crafted words to touch and capture the public sentiment. It's often said that Australians are sceptical about rhetoric and vision, that as a practical people we're more comfortable with the timelines of incremental plans and strategies. I'm not completely sure about that. The problem is less, it seems to me, in the language of ambition than the willingness and capacity to deliver. A strong vision, persuasively expressed and actually realised, provides both emotional and applied sustenance. By that criteria, Creative Nation has been an outstanding success. It was produced, as they said, at the end of our first century of nationhood. It might be viewed as a declaration that the cultural cringe and cultural strut are both over for good. Not all its recommendations were adopted, but enough were taken up to foster an environment that has seen the economic value of the creative industries triple. It is worth noting that in 1972 there were 19 Australian novels published. In 1992 there were 200. And a decade later, thanks largely to the parallel imports policy which enabled independent publishers to flourish, there were scores of Australian writers, many, many more writers being published, and being published both here and sold very successfully into markets all around the world, not just in English. We tend to obsess about the problems of the day. Until they're resolved, they can seem overwhelming. So it's striking to recall the pessimism that was around in 1993 when Creative Nation was written. The information and I'm quoting here from the report, the information superhighway threatened to force us into, and I'm not quoting now, but force us into an Orwellian world. They describe this rather dire, bleak, technological world. Globalisation was absolutely a threat to national uniqueness, and the fear that the most talented people would again depart these shores, never to return, runs as a thread all through that document. Reading the report now, and you have to read it online rather than as the beautiful, beautifully designed document it was at the time, with wonderful paintings and very carefully, beautifully put together, it's striking to realise just how much has changed and how much has remained the same. Clearly, the dystopian world that the authors feared that we may be entering has evaporated. The information superhighway has enabled us to participate and create in ways that were unimaginable even two decades ago. Globalisation has brought us closer, and the ease of movement has made the notion of the permanent expat exile a rarity. Instead, people come and go. They orbit, in Noel Pearson's language. As I've said, in many ways, Creative Nation bookmarked the end of a wave of cultural nationalism that had been bubbling since before Federation. Its elegant and inclusive definition of culture and cultural rights engaged with identity, with what it meant to be Australian. And as every former colony, this was defined by reference back. The task of asserting Australian identity and expressing it through art, culture, sport and the institutions of politics, law and science reached a zenith that two decades ago. In that context, the old myths still resonated in a way that they're not quite so strong these days. And the desire to cut the umbilical cord from the mother country shaped what was done and how it was done in a way that's not so relevant now. All this still echoes, but the world is profoundly different. And so there's a need to rethink the way we define identity and its cultural expression and underpinnings. I don't think that we have really begun to understand just how different this world is and what this mobile, globally connected, always on, decolonised, climate challenged world, which is rich but unequal, might really mean in terms of both our identity and our cultural expression around it. Like it or not, we're entering a profoundly different world in which we really need to recalibrate and articulate what being Australian actually means for the 21st century. So in revisiting Creative Nation in the context of the government's discussion paper on cultural policy, there are some things that jump out. The framing of that document, I think, is really good. It points to the diversity and strength of heritage, both Indigenous and settled. It points to the possibility of technology to destroy the tyranny of distance and to enable people to create as well as consume arts and culture. It points to the importance of education and the role of arts and culture in facilitating social cohesion. And it really does not back away from valuing art for its own sake. Reading between the lines, it suggests that it may be time to reconsider how there are new ways of funding the arts, to extend the pool of money available both for that art which is produced for its own sake and that which has an instrumental value that adds to social cohesion, that makes living in regional centres a richer experience, makes education more effective, tells the rest of the world who we are. By drawing on a funding from a much wider range of government departments, increasing private sector support, and looking at new models of funding which can help ensure long-term sustainability that draws on the lessons that we've learnt from a much more flexible and adaptable commercial system. So it's a good time, I think, to be thinking more broadly about cultural policy that starts with the arts and culture, it starts with the arts and stretches beyond them and engages differently with the world, with Australia as it is now, not as it was a century ago. Thank you.
Thanks, Julianne, and I hope that we get a chance to talk to you about some of those suggestions in that New Models, New Money report. And I have to say that that image of Australian cultural policy stuck somewhere between strutting and cringing is kind of firmly imprinted in my mind now. Will, would you like to give a response?
Interestingly enough, I've had my first direct engagement with Creative Nation very recently when I was asked to speak here today. And for the sake of what I have to say about it, I'm quite glad it was my first interaction with the report. I was quite impressed, and as I think Julianne noted, you can truly feel the effects of the aspired vision for a Creative Nation today. I'm a child of Creative Nation, it seems, and can see its application as I reflect on Australian culture during my lifetime. I can reflect on the environment in which it was developed. I can also, however, see its waning relevance in today's connected and diverse Australia. It seems that we are at a point where the environment has changed so much the prescriptions that were put down in 1994 need to be updated. And as I argue, not with more prescriptions, but a sustainable framework for the future nurturing of diversity in Australian culture. If it weren't such a demonstration of Australia's lack of confidence in itself, I would almost laugh at the lines that relate to a fear of the information superhighway as well as a fear of globalisation. It's difficult to define culture. It's even more difficult to define Australian culture. After searching Australian culture on Wikipedia, as you do these days, and seeing the headings of sport, religion, cinema, references to Vegemite, more sport and Australian actors, it forced me to think about my Australian culture. After all, I'm just as a reliable source of information as Wikipedia is. Australian culture in the world of Willamette is Italian yumcha, and a meal, I believe, which has become truly Australian, perfectly poached eggs with avocado, and a great coffee at a backstreet cafe in Melbourne, all in one weekend. Australian culture is seeing my friend Chris perform at the Australian Ballet, or Hamlet, at the Melbourne Theatre Company. It's defined in Parliament House in Canberra, that beautiful building that has the perfect balance between the power it represents and the somewhat relaxed feeling one might feel in an Australia Day picnic in one of our botanical gardens. It's the hundreds, if not thousands, of events, just like this one. Everything from the Denny Ute Muster with its feral ute competition and the Melbourne Comedy Festival. There is also the football, the four different types played in Australia, in Melbourne, Brisbane and Outback Australia. And of course, there is also experiencing one of the oldest cultures of humanity, that of the Indigenous Australian, which very sadly I don't get to experience enough in my everyday life. The common thread that runs through these experiences is that there really is no common thread that runs through them at all. These are simply a list of things that I've experienced over the last year or so. The last three or four major Australian tourism initiatives failed dismally, and it's my belief This is because you cannot define Australian culture. It's one of its most amazing qualities. Australian culture is true diversity that needs to be celebrated. We do not need to nurture each element of Australian culture in itself. We need to nurture the diversity of Australian culture by nurturing creativity. An interesting element of Australian culture is our lack of confidence in it. As Julianne made reference to, Creative Nation establishes a fear of globalisation and the impending information superhighway, which threatens to turn us into some sort of world homogenised culture. I'm not sure what's more strange, the fear of a world homogenised culture or the thought of one being developed in the first place. What these references do establish, and in a government report, mind you, is really a fear of losing our culture in a marketplace of cultures in a connected and small in the connected and smaller world in which we live today. Hence, stating this, Creative Nation seems to believe that our culture is somewhat inferior or less able to put up a fight with what it was apparently going to be replaced with. As we move to today, we look at what the government is proposing as a replacement to Creative Nation. The elements of this include a support of diversity with a protection of Indigenous culture, an innovation and participation goal, an excellence goal to push our culture to the world, and a socioeconomic goal, some of which Julianne made reference to. While the detail is lacking, I can kind of see maybe what they're trying to say. And from my interpretation, it seems almost a backflip on Creative Nation itself from a principal point of view, and attempts to establish a pride in the diversity of Australian culture. As with most of the policy that comes from all levels of government today, there is such a lack of vision for the power and beauty of this diversity. Something that is very close to my heart is creativity. It is my belief that creativity will continue to save the world. The question how we can develop creativity within individuals within Australia is, to me, a similar question as to how we should develop the arts. This weekend, the world lost one of its true creative geniuses. If you were one of the 8 million people who on October 6 watched Steve Jobs on YouTube tell all of us to stay hungry and to stay foolish, or you read or created one of the 6,049 tweets that were tweeted every second after the announcement of Steve Jobs' death, or you're just one of the devoted Apple fans like myself, then you know the magic of Steve Jobs is not from his freakish intelligence. The creative genius that created the most valuable company in the world did so by believing in himself and believing in his vision, literally living every day like he was going to die, and life was too short to worry about people, worrying about what people were going to think about you, reminding himself and us of this at every opportunity. It is this self-belief that we risk missing developing in young people in Australia if we do not begin to take pride in Australian culture as a whole. What's the point I'm trying to make? If you want more creativity and hence a stronger culture in Australia, then you need to focus on enabling young people to take risks and be different. We need to encourage risk-taking, and we need to remember failure is a good thing, purely an opportunity to learn. We need to end bullying, one of, if not, the biggest threats to Australian culture and creativity. If only our government would take the lead, demonstrate a pride in the unique culture of Australia being unlike any other culture in the world. I'd like to also take a stab at answering the question as to whether we should value arts for art's sake, regardless of its commercial value. Has Australia become too focused on commercialising creativity, the tagline of a marketing colleague of mine? To do this, I'll be drawing a comparison between Australia and Berlin, my second home. And I do truly mean Berlin the city, not Germany the country. For those of you who may have been there recently, in Berlin, creativity for the sake of creativity thrives like nowhere else in the world. It's been bred into their culture through the years of war, blockades and repression. It's the result and cause of unemployment and employment. Had Berlin not been creative, we would not have the punk movement, which inspired the indie movement, which is on its last legs today and will be sure to inspire the next world fashion subculture. You can now see a shift taking place in this city towards more of a commercial focus, but it's quite often the creative industries that are driving this growth: design firms, architects, marketing companies, even engineers. Something that I believe we are well down the road of here in Australia. In Australia, I don't believe we have enough art for art's sake or random acts of creativity. We do have a very strong commercial creative culture, which we must be proud of. There may be some who suggest that creativity for creativity's sake must always continue to exist, and creative industries are a sellout. It's my response that if we try to force our culture in any way, that we may end up like France, who legislate their culture into their schools and the media, and in fact restrict a whole generation of interpreting their culture in a modern, connected world. Finally, I'd like to take a little bit of a side note and point to the recent rebrand of Telstra. Why? This company ties together so many of the topics that I've just spoken about. The great Australian company, up there with Qantas and the Commonwealth Bank and loved by all. A very diverse company with a very, very diverse customer base and had to come out and stand on its own two feet around the same time as the Creative Nation did. It's tried to ride the back of being Australian. It's had visits to Asia and hosted guests from America. And now it has finally got the courage and pride to celebrate whom it really is. Nowhere have I seen before a company so boldly reflect Australian culture in their refusal to define a single market, instead focusing on diversity of colours, representing their customer base, and doing quite an incredible job of this in their confident television, print and online advertising. It's now time for Australia as a whole to take a risk and really celebrate what it means to be truly Australian, whatever that is. Thank you.
Thanks, Will. And we're going to move to the more informal part of the session, and we'll open up for some question and answers. And anyone that does have a question, we have a microphone at the back, and we'd ask that possibly that you go to the microphone because we're recording it for the radio. So I think we've already got a question here.
Thank you both. That was it was really great to hear. I've been involved in four consultations around the National Arts and Culture Policy. And a lot of the discussions, it actually took being involved in four of those consultations to prise apart what that draft policy is actually saying. And Will, I have to say that your perspective today is the one that most corresponds to what the artists and arts community in nationally and in South Australia have had to say about the draft policy. My interest is in the language that we have, as a part of that arts industry, that we have been feeding back through those consultations. And the lack of words that, or the lack of encouragement for artists and creative producers around innovation, risk taking, and the room for failure. When I brought this up recently, someone said to me, "What is it that artists do if not innovate, take risks, and sometimes fail and learn from that?" There seems to be no room in this document to encourage that kind of practice. Rather, what it leans quite heavily toward is industry and creating work for a creative industry. I understand that Robin Archer's beautiful speech on creative industries was published in the Griffith Review, which talked about the importance of not-for-profit creation of artwork, and as opposed to creation of artwork for profit in creative industries. And I'm just wondering about, you know, where that document really sits, and where you think it will eventually sit with regard to those two quite distinct and important legs.
Julianne?
I obviously can't speak on behalf of, you know, anyone else. I mean, I'm having an input into it as much as you. But I think that that what you've touched on is are two really important points. And I know that there is great sensitivity and concern in the sort of artistic communities that it's an either-or sort of proposition, that it's either doing art for its own sake and being creative and having the space to fail and, you know, creating great, you know, that whole sort of, you know, producing works of intrinsic value themselves because you must, you want to, you can. And then the industry stuff on the other side. Now, it was actually very interesting at the 2020 summit because this was obviously one of the really divides that happened in that discussion. And I think the tail of that is still apparent in this document that's out for discussion now. And the way I think that that in the 2020 process, that what happened was that there was an attempt to try and find a resolution, that it wasn't an either or, that there was a way of it all being seen in one in a sort of like a continuum, and that was very much the work that Robin has picked up on in her writing, and that is to say there is an enormous value, and nobody is disputing that value, of producing works of art for their own self. I mean, that is what the artist does, that's what they must do. They need to find mechanisms to support them in that work. And so that's one part of it, and that's the sort of kernel of everything else that spills out from it. So you can't have a creative industry unless you've got a creative core, which is the artist doing the original work. You can't have art which is aiding social cohesion unless you've got the creative core of people producing the original work. You can't have art which is filling the major institutions unless you've got somewhere where that work is being produced. So the institutions, the industries, the instrumental value that comes from art all depends on supporting very strongly the core where that great work is being produced. And so I think that sometimes there's a tendency to see it as either or, but I mean, in my mind, it's all very much part of the whole. One can't exist without the other. The people doing the sort of advertising campaigns for Telstra, you know, which express a certain sort of creativity, can't do that unless they're deeply immersed in the best practice that's happening in a creative space as well as in a commercial domain. So, I mean, I think that the policy has been quite careful, a discussion document, has been quite careful in talking about arts. I forget the phrase they use, it's core arts or something, I forget the...
Core arts. Core arts are the words. Heritage arts and creative industries.
Yeah, so that they're quite careful to give value to that. I think possibly there's a confusion that has taken place in for some... because there is that sort of divide between what some people call, and I don't like this term at all, the heritage arts, you know, the traditional arts, the orchestras and the operas and, you know, those sort of traditional arts, and then stuff that's happening in a newer, edgier space. And I think they've tried to get around that by talking about core arts. If it's not there clearly enough, I mean, I'm sure that the submissions that are being written are going to force them to think that through much more clearly in the, in the final document.
Will, would you like to comment on that?
I don't know how much more I can add to that response. No, it's very good. I think the two things I'd note again is just that the value of arts that can't be valued need to be valued, and it's absolutely core to everything and spurs the creative industry. There would be no creative industry without those core arts, as Julianne said. And if there is, if that is the direction they're going, then it sounds like it's just, a symptom of the risk aversion that's starting to develop within the Australian government, within our parliament, and within part of Australia as a whole, and I would encourage much more risk-taking.
I think we have another question. We have someone at the microphone. I'll ask you to go to the microphone. Sorry to interrupt, but perhaps you could cue in the microphone.
Thank you both very much for your comments, very valuable. I wonder if you could address the concerns by the Media, Entertainment and Arts Alliance, their current campaign for Safe Spaces for Aussie Faces, where actors, Australian actors, risk losing their places in Australian-made and Australian-funded films to overseas actors.
I've only seen, I think I saw a 7:30 report article on this a few weeks ago, and I don't know enough about the details.
Yeah, I don't really know enough either. But I do think that...
I think they're asking you, what do you think, not what you have prepared your answers for.
Well, if I don't know something, I can't give an opinion about it because I don't know enough.
I'm sure you can. I'm sure if you stand up here purporting to be an informed person, you could have an opinion.
Is this the bullying culture you were talking about?
Exactly. No. Telstra is the bullying culture which you so much glamorised. And Australian political life is based on thuggery and coercion, isn't it?
Thank you.
I think if you answer the lady's question, what your thoughts were, rather than your prescribed position.
Okay. Thank you for your comment. We'll allow people to respond as they wish. It is a democracy. Thank you very much.
Can I finish what I was starting to say? Because it might have helped the gentleman with his response. While I don't know the specifics of the MEAA campaign, I mean, I would certainly be seeking to encourage processes whereby Australian actors get to, you know, to be working in these, you know, productions which we do here. And I've wanted to pick up on Will's comment about the French example. I mean, the French have had a very prescriptive style of approach to maintaining French culture, which has had enormous success in lots of areas. But it's very interesting to see the flip side of that, that it doesn't necessarily mean that those French actors, by and large, find a voice, find an expression, find an audience beyond the Francophone world. So it's a matter, I think, of finding mechanisms which encourage that and make it possible without being so prescriptive that you cut off the knees.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. We had a question here. Would you mind taking it, giving it from the microphone? Thank you. That was first.
It's really in two parts. My first is regarding the Nobel Prizes that are awarded. And in the ABC news, it came after sport. What kind of culture do you have which considers that the ideas which justify a Nobel Prize come at the bottom of the list? In that connection, if I can just follow on, I was interested to hear about Mr. Jobs, and I thought that the account of what he had done was incredibly trivial. I don't see him as a great person at all. He's a good businessman, but judging by what the ABC had to say about him, he had done almost, what was it, give you an alarm clock that wakens you in the morning, you can get some local music easily, and very little of any intellectual content about it. That's point number one. The second one was a creative nation depends on its educational system. And I didn't hear anything about the educational system that I think I'd have liked to have heard a little bit about its contribution to a creative nation.
Okay.
Thank you.
We'll take that comment. Would anyone like to comment on education?
I'd like to comment on education, but you go first.
Yeah, sure. I agree with you completely on the point around the Nobel Prize winner. It should be celebrated more than an Olympic medal, which, you know, Australia is obsessed with celebrating. And on the point of Steve Jobs, I think I'd probably just disagree in that I think he's done amazing things. And if it's not the products that he's created, it's the people that he inspires by giving a demonstration or living a life of achieving a vision that he had, and something that I think all people should aspire to achieve.
Thank you. Another question.
Good afternoon. Yesterday afternoon, this man Steve here was out the front and saying, "Have you got an idea?" And I said, "Steve, I do have an idea. Has anybody noticed lately that Mr. Abbott is saying all the right things, but something is bothering him? Somebody is giving Mr. Abbott the heebie-jeebies via Twitter. That somebody is I." My name's Ian Carter, Venus Boy 1977. But as a consequence of this, I may, fingers crossed, be in a position to have some influence on policy development and contemplation in the 2020s. And I think that after Mr. Abbott's angry Australia, there will be an enlightened Australia. And surely, to paraphrase Edmund Barton, we are the world's only nation continent and continent nation. We are better than stopping the boats, surely. It is clear that we are destined eventually to be a great civilization. So we're talking about stopping boats. And meanwhile, I'm getting to that. It's to do with Creativity Australia. Meanwhile, IBM has just announced that it has developed a prototype of a computer with the capacity of the human brain. So I think that we could harness all of this potential that there is there. I remember Mr. Costello once saying that surely people on the dole could do lots of painting and completely disregarding the influence on consciousness that having to conform to those structures has. I think there's been work done in some countries about a creativity allowance. So that was one of my ideas, and I wondered what you guys thought of that. The second one was a commission, say, like the Productivity Commission, a National Technological Social Progress Commission to evaluate, because I think that at this point in time, our utilisation of technology is completely out of kilter with our comprehension of it. And the third and final thing is I thought to myself, it does really seem a bit indulgent to have Kirribilli, doesn't it? My mum, who died last year, was a quilting junkie. And I realised that it's these kind of little things like quilting groups, choirs, woodworking, they are the arteries, veins and capillaries of our communities. Could we think about having something that celebrates that at a national level, a national folk art and craft institution or gallery? Perfect place, Kirribilli.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Would you like to respond to any of those ideas or suggestions?
No, I think they stand quite well by themselves.
Cool. Thank you. Another question?
Yes, I have a question for Will. You mentioned that bullying was a factor that needs you would like to see considered. I'm not quite sure what you meant. You said very little. Would you be able to elaborate, please?
Sure. I guess I mean national bullying campaigns or getting rid of bullying to young people. It's one of the biggest things that adds, you know, a layer of an onion to a young person. A young person who might be an aspiring actor or an artist who might be not normal compared to the rest of their peers and be bullied and be pushed away from pursuing a purely creative life. And I just see it as a very big threat to young people at a young age and building up a sort of layers and layers of not doing what it is that they truly want to do.
Can I add that, which comes back to the question that was asked before about education, that I think that that's one of the things that's going to be so important about getting the arts into the national curriculum, so that if that becomes, you know, the teaching of arts and the valuing of creativity in the school situation happens as part of a formal process of recognition, that presumably will, if it's done well, give some sort of protection and some space for kids who feel a bit uncomfortable.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, it should be, you know, absolutely celebrated when someone at a very young age or at school wants to get up on stage and sing and dance and do whatever they want to do or paint or... Yeah.
Mm. Is there another person in the queue? Yes?
Just a very follow-on from that, just how do you do that and how do you fund and make space for risk-takers without the bullying? Your ideas, please.
It's a very big question. It's something that's so ingrained into, or bullying is something that can get so ingrained into our culture, and I think if you're going to overcome it, you need to almost shift a culture and a way of doing that. I think, as Julianne said, you know, putting it into the education system and the national curriculum and really celebrating it for what it is. Other ways of, off the top of my head, you know, giving young people examples of people who have achieved great things and don't listen to criticisms of other people is also a great way to inspire people to make, you know, I guess another pop culture reference like I did with Steve Jobs. Lady Gaga is a huge inspiration to millions of people, young people across the world, because she encourages people to be monsters and people to be, you know, celebrate whoever their unique talents. And I think it's an incredible thing because it's a young, although it may not come from a very reputable source, if it achieves a young person being able to accept that they're a monster or accept that they are who they are, then that's a very good thing.
One of the things which that came out in the research that we did for the New Models, New Money report that was published last year was to try and look at ways of providing financial support for people to follow their dreams and take those risks. Rather than a model which we've become very accustomed to of sort of government handouts, you know, that you apply for a grant because it fits within a parameter of, you know, money that's available. So we were very much interested in looking at other models that might work, whether that's sort of zero interest loans that people can take to try and do something else, getting the criteria changed at Centrelink so people can have work, you know, do work in these sorts of areas as a legitimate area and qualify for unemployment benefits and so on. So there's a whole lot of different ways of thinking about how you provide people not just with the space but with the money that they need to support themselves while they're trying to develop that capacity, which we hope will get taken up in this report as well.
Certainly the discussion today has given rise to some very interesting themes in terms of, on one level, cultural policy. It goes to the very heart of defining us, who we are, our identity, and giving us our meaning. At the same time, we're hearing from the questions that people are averse to risk, people get bullied if they're in the arts, and there's a certain vulnerability about being in the arts or practicing, being a practicing artist. I do invite you to have a look at the New Money, New Models report, because that does offer some quite inspiring new ways of perhaps how artists and people working in the creative sector and cultural sector can perhaps build a new form of sustainability. And I stood up because I would like to ask you rather formally if you'd like to have one more sort of comment that best captures the thoughts that you would like, you personally would like us to take away today.
I'll give you the honour of going first and I'll respond to you.
Oh, I was just going to do the reverse. I think the crux of what I was trying to say today is that the diversity of Australian culture in all of the millions of forms that it takes and the different combinations of the way in which all of us express our culture needs to be nurtured and celebrated. And I don't think that you can list any more, as it's difficult to do in any sort of government policy these days, prescriptions to achieve a certain outcome. A certain framework needs to be developed that allows for a sustainability of cultures to be culture to be developed in Australia.
And I would say that, as you have, that government can only enable; it can't mandate. In this area, especially, you don't want government to be mandating. But I really do think that there's a window opportunity here because the submissions on that discussion paper around culture policy are open until, I think, the 21st of October. So there's quite a good opportunity, I think, to write, respond, make a claim, because I think the government is actually genuinely open to hearing and trying to incorporate a new way of thinking about culture. And if their, you know, their ambitions are realised and it's a sort of a big 10-year vision with serious money attached, you know, it might result in something that's quite tangible and valuable for you. So I'd reply to the submission to the document.
Thank you. I wonder if you could join me in thanking our speakers.
This session from the Adelaide Festival of Ideas 2011 was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Bar Smith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library, and Flinders University Library.